Thank you so much, Melinda, and thank you. Although I suspect some of you might have been looking at your watch and noticed it's 11:45 and thinking, I hope he's a man of few words this morning. I'm delighted to be with you. I heard good news earlier. If Dan or somebody will walk across the street with me after church, I'll be glad to help take some of that barbecue off your hands and contribute to your fundraiser. So thank you for letting us know about that. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but I'm getting old. Truth is, I didn't have to wait till I got old for this to happen, but sometimes I run into people and I can't call their name. I'll see their face. I know that I know them from somewhere, but I can't quite put a name to the face or a finger on the connection. Where is that person from? What is their name? I rack my brain and I hope I don't get put on the spot. I've seen a couple of you nodding. I'm guessing I might not be the only person who has that problem. I may have it more often because there are a lot of people who see my picture in the Sunday school lesson every week and they know me very well by sight and I don't know them, but I'm sure I'm not the only person that struggles with that. There may be a few folk who have photographic memories or have done some sort of brain training, but I suspect for most people, it happens to all of us. Sometimes I never do figure out who that person is. Sometimes I sneak around and ask somebody else who it is. I did that this week. We had a luncheon for our graduates, and a woman came over and asked me to. She had an autographed dog, and wanted me to sign her dog. Now, she just came over real quickly and went back, and I turned to the Lynn Brinkley beside me and said, who was that? And she just laughed and laughed. It was one of my students I've had in a half dozen classes. She was wearing a wig. I'd never seen her in a wig. Her hair's usually up here. She had a wig all tucked under and different color, and I didn't recognize her. Sometimes, when I sit and I get a chance to think long enough, it'll pop up. And what a delight it is when you can finally put two and two together. Maybe you know that feeling. Can you imagine what it would be like to spend some time talking to a familiar person that you can't quite name, and when the light comes on, you realize it's Jesus? That's the story in our text for today. When we come to the text, it's still Easter Sunday, which may remind us that the Easter season on the church calendar lasts for 49 days. This is officially the third Sunday of Easter, but in the text, it's still the first Sunday, sometime in the late afternoon. And two disciples, not among the 12, but disciples still, were walking away from Jerusalem and toward Emmaus, which was their apparent home. They had been present with the others when the women came back that early morning and proclaimed that the tomb was empty and an angel had said Jesus was alive. Peter and John had run to check it out, and they confirmed the story that the tomb was empty, but they didn't see Jesus. Maybe that was the last straw for these two disciples. Jesus was dead. His body was gone. Their hopes were vanquished. They decided to go home. One of those disciples was named Cleopas. Some writers have imagined that he might be the same Clopas who's mentioned in the Gospel of John. This Clopas's wife was named Mary. She's the Mary who stood together with the mother of Jesus at the foot of the cross. Perhaps it was this Clopas and his wife Mary who were walking that dusty road back to a village that's now lost to us. We don't know where Emmaus was. Luke tells us it was 600 stadia from Jerusalem. That works out to a little less than 7 miles. That's not a long walk for people who are used to walking everywhere. Whatever their identity, the two disciples were engaged in a heavy-duty conversation about the crushing events of the past week. What else could they talk about? They had placed their hopes in Jesus. They had followed him. They were close to him, and their hope had been crushed by his betrayal and crucifixion. And then early that morning, this curious story about the empty tomb seemed to confuse them even more than it encouraged them. And so Luke portrays the two as being so engrossed in their conversation, they didn't even notice when someone else started walking beside them. And when they became aware that they had company, they didn't recognize the person. It shouldn't be surprising. You and I know it's Jesus because we've read the story. And there are other post-resurrection appearances in which Jesus appears, but he remains incognito, as it were, until he chooses to reveal himself. Luke does not suggest that the travelers were not paying attention or not looking close enough. The text says their eyes were kept from recognizing him. Perhaps Jesus wanted them to think through their theology without being distracted by the knowledge of his identity. Like as with Thomas, perhaps he wanted them to learn to believe in his word, even when they couldn't see his face. The New Revised Standard Version says Jesus asked them, "What are you discussing with each other?" A more literal Greek reading would be something like, "What is it you're throwing back and forth? Or what is this you're kicking around together?" They seemed surprised, amazed that anybody could not know what they were talking about, who would not be familiar with the events of the past few days. It appeared that he was also walking from Jerusalem. How could he not be aware? It was Cleopas who asked. That's how we know his name, because Cleopas asked the question, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place in these days?" Once again, Jesus pressed for a little more information. "Tell me more about what happened." So the travelers responded with a quick review. These events, they said, concerned Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus was actually a quite popular name in the first century. It's equivalent to Joshua. Lots of kids were named Jesus. And so they distinguished him by calling him Jesus of Nazareth. He had been understood to be a prophet, they said, and he had demonstrated himself to be powerful in word and in deed before people. And everyone agreed that only somebody endorsed by God or empowered by God could do these things. And they had begun to believe this Jesus might be the Messiah. There were others who were not so pleased with Jesus. And so the two explained that the chief priests and rulers, the ruling body of the Jewish people, had perceived him to be a threat to them, and they had managed to collude with the governing authorities and to engineer Jesus' death. And that was sad enough in itself, but they said, "But we had hoped that he would be the one to redeem Israel." Faithful Jews expected a Messiah, but they commonly imagined that he would be a military sort of Messiah. He would be a powerful person who would deliver Israel from the Roman authorities that had occupied their territory. They expected he would bring them back to independence and glory as a nation. But Jesus was dead. I guess he couldn't have been the one. Even the evidence of the empty tomb did not encouraged them. They spoke with amazement of the women's report about the empty tomb, but they didn't know what it meant. They weren't yet convinced that Jesus really was risen, and certainly not convinced that he was the Messiah. They didn't have mental categories for the kind of Messiah Jesus intended to be. Well, Jesus' response was as surprising as his first one. At first, they thought, I can't believe you don't know anything about this. And then when he responded again, their thought was, I can't believe how much he knows about this. For he began to speak to them as if he couldn't believe their lack of understanding and their failure to be certain about Jesus. They soon learned that he knew all about Jesus. He knew all about the issue of whether Jesus had been the Messiah, and he speaks as if he was shocked that they misunderstood the scriptures and misunderstood what Jesus himself had taught them. Oh, how foolish you are, he said. Doesn't sound very polite for a stranger walking along the side of the road with you. Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory? Like most of their contemporaries, these two disciples had probably been rather selective in their study of the Hebrew Scriptures. They tended to magnify the texts that portrayed the Messiah as a superpowered hero and downplay the ones that seemed to portray a person who suffered. And so Jesus shifted into a sort of rabbi mode. He offered his own interpretation of the scriptures that spoke of a suffering Messiah. The text says he started with the law and moved into the prophets. And before he finished, he even spoke from the writings. The Hebrew Bible is divided into those three parts: the Torah, or the law, the prophets, and the writings. What might he have said? Have you thought about that? What text would Jesus use from the Torah? Would he use from the law, from the first five books of the Bible? We don't normally think of those as having anything to do with the Messiah. Perhaps he talked about the Day of Atonement and the scapegoat ceremony in Leviticus 16. Maybe he talked about Deuteronomy, in which Moses, who suffered greatly, predicted the coming of another prophet like himself. Later in the book of Acts, two different sermons identify that coming prophet like Moses as being Jesus. Several texts from the prophets could have been appropriate. Jesus might have quoted from one of the latter two servant songs of Isaiah, for they spoke of a coming servant of God who would suffer vicariously on behalf of the people. Though cut off from the land of the living, they said, he would rise to see life again, in Isaiah 50 and 52 and 53. Those texts, more than any other, are quoted in other places in the New Testament as the early church tried to explain how it was that Jesus was the Messiah, and yet Jesus suffered. He wasn't a conquering superhero from heaven. He was a different kind of Messiah. Perhaps Jesus mentioned the prophet Zechariah, who had spoken of a king who rides a donkey and a pierced victim, a wounded friend, a smitten shepherd. He spoke from the book of Psalms, which belongs to the writings. Maybe he had in mind Psalm 69:21, "For my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink." Perhaps he mentioned Psalm 22, which speaks of one who's been forsaken by God, who's mocked by a crowd, who's taunted to pray for deliverance while other people cast lots for his clothing. In fact, Jesus' cry of dereliction from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me?" appears to be a direct quotation from Psalm 22, verse 1. Can you imagine listening to him tell us these things? Well, they drew near to home, the author suggests, and Jesus kept walking as if he planned to go on, but his companions insisted, "No, you need to stop for dinner. Go ahead and spend the night with us." Jesus agreed. And in good time, Luke portrays them reclining about the dinner table. Soon, the stranger that had taught them like a rabbi was asked to say the blessing. In traditional Jewish fashion, he took a small loaf of bread and he broke it and he passed it to the others while praying. Perhaps the prayer he recited was a traditional blessing, like one that's still said among faithful Jews. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu, melech ha'olam, ha'motzi lachem min ha'aretz. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who brings forth bread from the earth. And in that moment, Luke says, in that moment, their eyes were opened and they recognized him. Was it the sound of those familiar words? Did they see the nail prints when he passed around the bread? It matters not. The Lord had veiled their eyes before and now he'd uncovered them. No doubt it was significant for Luke, as well as for the early church, that Jesus became known to them through word and through sacrament as Jesus expounded the scriptures and broke the bread. Now, doesn't that make for a good story with a happy ending? But Luke isn't through. The story takes a sudden and unexpected twist. In the very moment that the disciples recognized Jesus, he vanished. He disappeared. A literal translation of the Greek means he became unseen. He disappeared from their vision. But now they could see that he had been with them all along. And they were amazed that they had not recognized him earlier. And they said to themselves, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?" Memory plays an important role in understanding, and now the disciples were beginning to understand. Of course, a part of being a faithful disciple is to share what you have learned and what you know. And so these two immediately got up and hurried back to Jerusalem, back across those 7 miles in the dark, and found the other disciples who were still awake, and they shared the good news with them. When they arrived, they discovered that Jesus had also appeared to Peter, and he had convinced the others that it was true. The Lord was risen. Cleopas and his companion then shared with them all they could remember of the conversation they had with Jesus on that dusty road to Emmaus. Wouldn't you have loved to be in that room? But what of it? Does it also have a word for us who are gathered here, who've never seen Jesus face to face, who've never taken bread from his hands? Our text is a charming story, but it's more than charming. We can't underestimate the importance of this report. Much of the early church's understanding of Christ and much of our own theology has its roots in what those gathered disciples learned on that first Easter night. All Jesus had said was true. He was risen. He was alive. And he was not through with them. Can we agree that Jesus is not through with us either? Perhaps we can learn something from these two disciples. It's unlikely we will ever see Jesus face to face on this earth in this life, but that does not mean we cannot experience Jesus' presence. Now, if we truly want to meet Jesus, how do we go about it? Perhaps Cleopas and his companion can offer us a clue. They came to see Jesus through a process that involved listening, inviting him into their home, and sharing a symbolic meal. Do we listen for the voice of Jesus, for an inner sense of the Spirit's presence, for a gentle nudge against our hearts leading us down the right path? It's all too easy for us to think of prayer as only a matter of us talking and pouring out our hearts to Jesus. Can we recognize that prayer must also involve some listening, some time to allow Jesus to pour his heart into us? The two disciples also invited Jesus into their home. Is there a place for Jesus where we live? Is Christ's presence more than just having a picture of the classic picture of the poor old man or woman praying over a loaf of bread with folded hands? Do the Bibles in our homes remain on the shelf or the nightstand, or do we open them and read them and ponder as we seek to learn more of God's love and God's way? That's another way to meet Jesus. And finally, Cleopas and company recognized Jesus when he prayed and broke the bread before their evening meal. There's something about ritual that speaks to us. Most of us don't celebrate the Lord's Supper every Sunday, but when we do, we have a tangible reminder that Jesus lived in real flesh and shed real blood and did it for us. And even when we don't have the bread and wine before us, we hear the word of God proclaimed and we sing of God's presence. And if we are paying attention, we might just meet Jesus right here in this sanctuary through the ritual of worship. Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us? Lord, make our hearts burn today. Amen.